Wine and Crime contains graphic and explicit content which may not be suitable for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to Wine and Crime, the podcast where two friends chug... sometimes wine, not today. Chat true crime and unleash their worst Minnesotan accents. My name is Amanda.
My name is Lucy.
And this week we do have a very special fan pick, although our fan picker wants to remain anonymous. So you'll just have to trust us, which is like asking you to trust the government. I know it's not easy.
Not something you want to do.
But we swear that this was a fan pick. And our very special fan picker has chosen the topic of academia atrocities.
Yeah.
But made very clear that they did not want us to cover school shootings, which, like, thank you.
Yeah.
Today is much better than that.
I have a case. It's quite dark. Mm-hmm. It's technically a school shooting, but it doesn't involve children.
Okay.
So we'll just call it a workplace shooting.
We'll call it a workplace shooting. We'll take it. Mm-hmm. We'll take it. My case is also very dark, but unconventional today. So we're going off script a little bit. Going off book.
I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
I'm okay with it.
I'm not going to say it'll be a fun episode. But it will be an informative episode. That I can promise.
We'll try our darndest.
Yep. It's also pretty funny because our anonymous fan picker recommended the pairing today be a pint glass full of vodka. Which I found deeply relatable and also hilarious, but it's 1 p.m. as we record this on a Friday as the crow flies. My body simply cannot handle that. But this did get me thinking about, like, what's the beverage of choice for educators? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I wondered if there were, like, statistics about that. And I started, you know, taking a little walk through the internet to find out. And while I didn't really find that specific answer, I did find a very informative and hilarious blog post on boardteachers.com. Outlining, quote, the ultimate drink pairing list for every stressful teaching situation.
Oh, okay.
I know we have a lot of teachers who listen, including, you know, my own sister. Hi, Ashley.
Hey, Ashley.
So I'm going to breeze through these recommendations very quickly.
Question.
Yes.
And I'm sure you'll get to it.
I'm sure I will.
Is there a distinction between, like, kindergarten, first, second grade teachers and, like, college professors?
No, but I think the scenarios will make kind of clear what sort of age group or, like, caliber of educator these fall in.
Okay.
So, for instance, number one, to pair with reading parent emails, they recommend White Russians.
Okay.
They said you don't want to respond very quickly, so drink this slowly and respond after you've had some time to settle down. Good advice.
You don't want to slam a White Russian.
You don't. You'll get gut rot and diarrhea. Number two, for a new student, they recommend a rum and Coke. This says the entire balance of your room is about to change. It could be good, then you could add a little more Coke. It could be a disaster, and then you'll add a little more rum. Number three, for the first sneeze of the school year, rip a lemon drop.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you need something tough. This says the weather changes, you can't go outside, you hear that sound that makes your whole body cringe, you know the sickness is upon you. Arm yourself with Lysol and lemon drops.
Lysol and lemon. Okay.
It's just medicine.
It is.
For the moment you get home, crack an ice cold beer is what they recommend.
Mm-hmm.
The days could be long and you need something to just sit with and sip during your reruns on Netflix as you pass out on the couch. Honey, preach.
Yes. That's true for any job.
It really is. There's something so satisfying about the occasional ice cold beer.
Mm-hmm. The end of a long day.
Number five, for the night you don't have to grade, margaritas, baby. Pairs perfectly with Taco Tuesday, and everyone knows we need our Mexican takeout. Treat yourself. Love that.
Yes.
Number six is just Wednesdays. Wednesdays, I guess, are just a stressful teaching situation.
It's just smack dab in the middle of the week.
Yeah. For Wednesdays, they recommend straight up Fireball.
I also feel like all the activities were on Wednesdays.
Yes, they were. Mm-hmm. Fucking field trips. Yeah. Like always on Wednesdays.
Field day.
So annoying. Why?
Just shit. There was something, always something on a Wednesday.
Right in the middle. And also, my grandma Eileen used to call this her little cinnamon drink. She loved Fireball. This says nothing gets you back in the game like some hot cinnamon shots. It will also end the thought of two more days until Saturday. For faculty meetings, they recommend bourbon straight.
Yeah. Who are you trying to impress? You're in a faculty meeting.
Yeah. Faculty meetings can cause any person to drink one slow pour just for their existence. The rest of the bottle is there for those people that keep raising their hands and asking questions.
Oh, no, that would be me.
It would. It totally would.
I already raised my hand and asked a question this episode.
I love it. For Friday afternoon bus duty, they recommend a Long Island iced tea.
Bus duty. Hopefully not driving the bus.
No, it's like making sure the students get on the right bus in elementary school.
Oh, I saw the cutest thing on TikTok yesterday.
What?
It's a bike bus. So you have like a couple of adults, like in, they had like them in yellow ponchos, and they bike. They have a route around like the neighborhood and they bike, and then kids get on the bus by just pulling into their bike parade, and they have like a whistle. They bike with the kids to school.
That's cute. I like that.
It was adorable. I know. There was like dozens of them.
That's really cute. Mm-hmm. That's real cute.
Dangerous. Depends. You couldn't do it everywhere.
No, but you know, it's a fun idea. Mm-hmm. To commemorate a day off from school, they recommend Red Bull and vodka.
Oh.
Because you need to get up off the couch and be a human, but you need a kickstart and the coffee is not doing it. Bring on the party waters.
I like a vodka Red Bull here and there.
I do too. I do too. When I went to see Aqua, I had a double vodka Red Bull and I just sipped it throughout the night and I felt like I was on top of the world. I was the Barbie girl.
That's what I was drinking when we saw American Authors.
Oh my God, that's hilarious. It was the best day of your life.
It was. Mm-hmm. Play that one song. just that one, you know, the one.
You know the one. From the Lois commercial. For paper grading, they recommend mimosas. They are light and refreshing. It won't ruin your day, and you can start drinking them early. That stack of papers looks way less terrible after some bubbly and orange juice. Plus, there's the added bonus of vitamin C. It's for your health.
I agree with all of this.
I do too. They recommend wine for midterms. Like a fine wine, the papers get better with time, mostly because you stop reading them and just hand out A's like Oprah. To ring in spring break, they recommend daiquiris and pina coladas. Love that. And for the end of school entirely, they recommend sangria. It reminds you of all the good times, the sunshine and friends. You don't feel bad about downing a whole pitcher because there's fruit in it, right?
Salad.
Irish coffee is recommended for Christmas break. There's a paper jam in the only copier for the entire school, they recommend Jaeger bombs.
Also medicinal.
Also medicinal. And, you know, that's the list. But I just thought that was very informative.
I love that.
Like I said, I'm not drinking a pint glass of vodka, but I do have a gross combination of an iced mocha from Dunkin' Donuts and a sparkling blackberry lemonade water that I can crack.
Stop.
It's a Waterloo.
I have a Simply Spiked Limeade blackberry flavor.
Are you kidding me? Why are we like,
we're drinking the same
twinning
thing.
Yours have booze in it? Yeah, spiked.
Yeah, spiked. Contains alcohol.
Should we crack on three?
Yes.
One, two, three.
Oh, twin crack.
Twin cracks. Double crack.
Cheers.
God bless. All right. Before we dive into your incredible contribution today, should we take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsors?
I would love to.
Let's do it.
You ever tried to break a bad habit and it's a lot harder than you expected it to be?
Mm-hmm.
Like climbing Mount Everest in flip-flops? That's not going to work.
Mm-mm.
And you know what? We've been there too, but here is a breath of fresh air. Fume. It's not about giving up, it's about switching up. Fume takes your habit and simply makes it a better, healthier, and a whole lot more enjoyable habit.
It does. Fume is an innovative, award-winning flavored air device that does just that. Instead of vapor, Fume uses flavored air. Instead of electronics, Fume is completely natural. And instead of harmful chemicals, Fume uses delicious flavors. So you get it. Instead of bad, Fume is good. It's a habit that you're free to enjoy and makes replacing your bad habit easy. Your Fume comes with an adjustable airflow dial and is designed with movable parts and magnets for fidgeting, giving your fingers a lot to do, which is helpful for de-stressing and anxiety while breaking your bad habit. I am obsessed with the fidgeting aspect of mm-hmm. the Fume device. It just feels so good in your hand. I'm a big fan. And then the pods, like the flavor pods that they have, are so good. These cores. I'm a big fan of the citrus core like line. So I like the orange vanilla. My favorite is the sparkling grapefruit. It Yum. Is becoming like raspberry lemon season for me over here as the weather gets warmer. I was literally changing mine out seasonally. So over the winter, it was like maple pepper and white cranberry. And now I'm in my spring Fume era. I'm obsessed.
Yeah, it's like the scented candles.
Yep.
You switch and it up.
Plus, Fume just released a magnetic stand for your Fume, so there's no more losing it around the house. You have like a designated spot to put it. It's built with fidgeting in mind. You can spin your Fume around on the magnetic stand. They've thought of everything. I'm in love.
So start the year off right with the good habit by going to tryfume.com/gals and getting the journey pack today. Fume is giving our listeners of this show 10% off when they use our code GALS, G-A-L-S, to help make starting the good habit that much easier. So one more time, go to tryfume, that's tryfume.com/gals, and treat your habit.
Treat it. I look back on sometimes when I smelled really bad. Like, I think about just puberty and, like, mm-hmm. how stanky I was as a teenager. And wish that I had just had access to products that would take care of that for me. And fortunately, we do now. Lumi Whole Body Deodorant has made it so that I can smell my best every day, and so can you. And unlike certain other deos, Lumi is powered by mandelic acid to deliver outrageous 72-hour odor control everywhere, from your pits to your feet, and yes, even your privates. In fact, it was patients' concerns about private part odor that originally inspired the OBGYN who invented Lumi. Then fast forward 6 years, and our game-changing whole body deodorant has now earned over 300,000 five-star reviews from people like me who love feeling confident from head to toe. And new customers also get $5 off Lumi's starter pack with code GALS5, that's G-A-L-S-5, at LumiDeodorant.com. Tell us more, Lucy.
Okay, the pubescent, mm-hmm. like adolescent BO thing is
pubescent
so real.
Reek.
You can smell it right now, can't you?
Yes.
Yeah, speaking of like the prepubescent teenage stink, mm-hmm. I remember distinctly my first deodorant. It was like rainforest scented.
Yeah.
And it did not improve the smell. It just sort of covered it up with like, then you just smelled like BO plus rainforest.
The perfect combination.
Not great. And again, that only applies to your armpits when we all know that your armpits are not the only place that can get a little stanky. So we've talked before about we love this crossover that you can use Lumi all over your body. It is seriously safe to use anywhere on your body. Pits, under boobs, thigh folds, belly buttons, butt cracks, your vulva, your feet, everywhere. Like Amanda said, this was created by an OBGYN. So it's safe to use. It's mm-hmm. pH balance for safe use below the belt. So unlike certain traditional deodorants that try to mask odor with a fragrance, Lumi is formulated and powered by mandelic acid to stop the odor before it starts. So it's like that pre-odorant. Mm. So even if you are well out of your pubescent era, you gotta try Lumi, because that is a complete game changer when it comes to body odor.
So like I said at the top, Lumi Starter Pack is perfect for new customers. It comes with a solid stick deodorant, cream tube deodorant, two free products of your choice, and I highly recommend the Mandy Body Wash and the deodorant wipes. The wipes are my favorite things ever. And free shipping. So as a special offer for our listeners, new customers get $5 off a Lumi Starter Pack with code GALS5 at LumiDeodorant.com. That equates to over 40% off your starter pack when you visit LumiDeodorant.com and use code GALS5 and treat your scent.
Treat it.
All right, Lucy, what is our background in psych and your case for today for academia atrocities?
I'm going to go ahead and say my case is the psych because it is
wild.
Psychotic.
All right. I love it. Okay.
So just little history, little background for academia specifically.
In general. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So academia refers to the life, community, or world of teachers, schools, and education. Mm-hmm. The word academia is a Latinization of the word academy, with the IA suffix suggesting a geographic identity. So it's like a location. It's like a centralized location.
Sure.
The first known use of the word was in 1903, later than I would have thought.
That is recent.
Yeah. Academia goes back to Plato's School of Philosophy, which was founded approximately 385 BCE.
Before Christ even.
Exactly. At a place called Academia, spelled with a K, which was a literal school.
Oh, okay.
So this building served as a sanctuary of Athena, the goddess of wisdom, and it was located a little north of Athens.
Cute.
According to my boyfriend, Encyclopedia Britannica, there had been an olive grove, a park, and a gymnasium sacred to the legendary Attic hero Academus, or Hecademus, at the site. So
we've never been able to escape PE in schools.
No, we got olives, we got nature, we got exercise.
Yep.
So it's
the three pillars of academia.
Exactly. I would go read in an olive grove. That sounds
my God.
So fucking pleasant.
It really fucking does.
Find you a warm rock, just sit on it like a lizard in an olive grove.
I love sunning myself on a warm rock.
Mm-hmm. Ugh. Then it gets too warm.
Yeah.
5 to 10 minutes.
If you have a Long Island iced tea to keep you cool.
True. Or if you're cold-blooded.
Or to deal with bus duty, then you're good to go.
Yes, you are very good to go. Mm-hmm. So at that time, the school was a corporate body organized for the worship of the muses. God, ancient Greece was fucking ridiculous.
My jam.
Most scholars infer from Plato's writings that instruction originally included math, dialectics, natural science, and preparation for statesmanship.
Okay. The SATs.
Yeah. The academy closed in 528 CE, Christ even. When the Emperor Justinian closed it along with other pagan schools. Mm. Getting into the religiosity of things around that time. So we often hear the words college and university when discussing forms of higher education, but what is the difference between the two? Because there is a difference.
Okay. I'm glad you're covering this because I am curious.
So colleges tend to be smaller and focused on a specialized field of study. Mm-hmm. Like at a university, there might be different colleges.
Oh, okay.
College of Fine Arts, College of Business.
Under the umbrella of a broader university. So like the University of Minnesota College of Business.
Exactly.
School of Business.
Yeah.
Cool.
Or you could just have a college like MCTC.
Yep.
Smaller, more focused on certain shit. So there are also different types of colleges, such as liberal arts colleges, vocational colleges, community colleges, and specifically designated colleges for specific student populations. So that would be what I'm referring to under the university umbrella.
Okay.
Universities offer both undergraduate and graduate degrees. Most of them also tend to serve as research institutions.
Mm.
So, colleges just a little bigger, offer a little more, and then have different departments and colleges. Sure. Sometimes. The oldest existing and continually operating education institution in the world is the University of Caruin.
Not at all what I would have guessed because I've never heard of it. I was going to assume it was something like Oxford, but nope.
We'll kind of get to, well, we won't get to Oxford, but Oxford is pretty fucking old too.
Is this the University of Tatooine, whatever you just said, that's a planet in Star Wars. Anyway, is that like an ancient Roman or Greek institution?
It's Moroccan.
Moroccan. Fucking cool.
Mm-hmm. So it's also known as the University of Al-Karouin.
Okay.
I'm sorry about the pronunciation. Mm-hmm. It was founded in 859, Christ even.
Wow.
That's
some year one
ago.
Shit.
Mm-hmm. So it's located in Fez, Morocco. It's a religious school and was founded by Fatima Al-Firi with an associated school. Mm-hmm. The oldest known university in Europe, which you might think is Oxford,
but
is
it's not.
University of Bologna.
Oh, Bologna.
Bologna. Mm-hmm. Delicious. It's in Italy. It was founded in 1088.
Damn.
The oldest university in the Americas is located in the Dominican Republic, and it is St. Thomas Aquinas University.
Cool.
It's one of those words I read more than I say. I actually have no idea how to say that. Aquinas.
I think it's Aquinas or Aquinas. I feel like I've heard it both ways. Someone's screaming, I'm sorry, we are not academics. Well, Lucy is way more than me, but we're doing our best.
Aquinas. So that school was established in 1538 by Pope Paul III.
Classic Paul.
The earliest American institutions, and I will say institutions in what is now the United States, of higher learning were the four-year colleges of Harvard, founded in 1636, William and Mary, founded in 1693, Yale, founded in 1707, and Princeton, founded in 1746, and then King's College, which is now known as Columbia, in 1754.
Okay.
I think we knew that Harvard was the first, the oldest one.
We've talked about that before for some reason. I don't remember why, but whatever.
Dorms.
Remember anything. Oh,
the dorm
right.
Ones.
Yes. Okay.
Those are the oldest dorms.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these early American colleges were founded by religious denominations. Dominations, that too.
Both.
Many of them later became universities, and American colleges and universities imitated German models of education, which combined the Prussian ideal of academic freedom with the native tradition of educational opportunity for the many.
Hmm.
It's free. It's free thinking. Ideas are free flowing. Also, mm-hmm. we want as many white men as possible to have access to these institutions.
There it is.
Fun fact, in 1840, Harvard University only cost $75 a year to attend.
I wonder what that is with inflation. It's still not nearly as expensive as it is now, but
with inflation, that would be $2,658.77 a year.
Cool. Now it costs like a small house per year.
Yeah. Getting in's the easy part.
Yeah.
I say that like I have applied.
Oh my God. We would be shoo-ins at Harvard.
Give us
our honorary degree. Yeah. What? Like it's hard? We're going to L Woods the fuck out of this.
The growth of schools in the U.S. was prompted. Okay. I think this was really interesting. Was prompted by the Morrill Act. Morrill, M-O-R-R-I-L-L. Not like.
So like a name?
It's a name. Yeah.
Okay.
Of 1862. So this act was passed on my birthday, July 2nd, 1862, making it possible for the states to establish public colleges funded by the development or sale of associated federal land grants.
Interesting. Okay.
So that's how they got the money to
build these schools.
Yep. So over 10 million acres provided by these grants were taken from the Native Americans.
Yeah.
Which is its own problem.
Uh-huh.
These new colleges gave opportunities to the working class by emphasizing agriculture and mechanical arts. So I think there was just less like private money involved.
Sure.
That people could afford to go there. And then those tended to be in more rural areas, more rurally focused educational tracks. Mm-hmm. Major universities such as Nebraska, Clemson, and Cornell were charted as land-grant schools. Mm. The second Morrill Act of 1890 was aimed at former Confederate states and sought to rectify racial discrimination. That was the purpose. Mm-hmm. But of course, at this time, we're separate but equal times.
Yep.
So this act required states to establish separate land-grant institutions for Black students, or to demonstrate that admissions were not restricted by race.
So is this how some
HBCUs
were established?
Yep.
Okay.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I knew that HBCUs were essentially born out of segregation. Mm-hmm. But this is interesting.
I know. I had not really thought back to like how those were started. But it also makes sense why you have some really huge schools like Nebraska that are kind of in the
middle of nowhere.
I don't want to say the middle of nowhere, but
they kind of are.
They're very rural, but they're like really well established, excellently
and
funded,
highly
schools.
Attended schools. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that was.
I mean, even
this-
like Penn State is gives me like similar vibes to that the university in Nebraska because like State College is in the middle of Amish country. Like you are not close to Philly or Pittsburgh. You're not close to like a major city in Pennsylvania. So I would imagine that this might have also been built out of one of these land grant.
Could have been
subsidies.
A benefactor of the land grant thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I thought that was kind of cool. Mm-hmm. A specific question I had was, I didn't know what tenure was. Mm-hmm. Do you know what tenure is?
I mean, I only know it like through the context of like, it's a contract, essentially. That's like how I've understood it. Like if you are a tenured professor, you're like, you have a contract that you can like practice for X amount of years.
Yeah, it's like indefinitely, I think.
Yeah, so, but some have like actual end dates.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah,
it makes it hard to get fired is what I've heard. If you're tenured.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
So academic tenure is an indefinite appointment that can only be terminated for cause or under extraordinary circumstances, such as financial difficulty and program discontinuations.
Or intense scandal. Mm-hmm. Which, you know.
Well, that's the extraordinary circumstances.
Right.
The modern concept of tenure in the U.S. higher education originated with the 1940 Statement of Principles on Academic Freedom and Tenure. The principal purpose of tenure is to safeguard academic freedom. So this way, tenure provides the conditions for faculty to pursue potentially controversial research and innovation and draw evidence-based conclusions free from corporate or political pressure. Mm-hmm. So it makes it so that the school can't be like, hey,
you're fired because you're looking into or supporting XYZ.
Yeah. Or like, we get money from Philip Morris. You can't, you know, research how cigarettes affect lung health or something like that.
We're seeing cases right now coming out in regards to like this exact protection that you're talking about in regards to professors that are speaking out like in support of Palestine and Palestinians being protected by similar laws.
Huh. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm sure that because that is such a large conversation right now, that's like very much in the news, but I would have to imagine that anytime there's like a huge political disruption or, you know,
social
justice issue. I mean, I would imagine that there were similar, you know, uses of these laws of protection around Black Lives Matter and when George Floyd was murdered and all, you know, like it protects these teachers for their individual stances or, you know, research or support of political or, you know, otherwise academic movements outside of their institution. So they can't just be fucking fired for like being aligned with something that maybe the college hasn't made a stance on or that the college itself isn't aligned with, which I think is an important protection.
Yeah, it's intended to promote stability and also academic freedom.
Well, right. I mean, if we're encouraging free thinking and, you know, intellectual debate and conversation, then essentially limiting a professor's free speech and saying and shutting that shit down would make no fucking sense.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Critics say that it can lead to a lack of accountability, meaning like a professor, if they had tenure, could just say whatever the fuck they wanted to say and no one can do anything about it. But, you know, I think the good outweighs the bad for the most part.
Well, we're always going to exploit free speech, you know, human beings who are fucking shitty, which is there are many, you know, it's like this doesn't give you free license to just like go be like bigoted and racist and like and cause real harm. But yeah, that could you could get into some tough situations, I think, because it's like who's the deciding factor on like what's protected as free speech and what is like, you know, harmful rhetoric? You know, it's like pornography. Like it could be hard to describe it, but like, you know, it when you see it. But then if you have to defend it or prosecute it in like a court,
then you have to define it.
Right. That would be. I'm so glad we don't work in fucking academia. This is way too confusing.
Or law.
Oh my God. Can you imagine if I were your lawyer?
Oh my God. What were Corey and I watching the other day? We were, it was something about like.
Was it the Traitors and you want to hire Phaedra as your lawyer? Because same.
Yes. We were watching Oppenheimer and it was the guy who was going to press the button to push the test, just the test bomb. And Corey was like, can you imagine like being on this research team and living through this and like just juggling all the ethics of the whole and the politics of the whole situation? And I was like, dude, I was on jury duty and I almost broke. Yeah. So no.
No, I can't.
I can't.
Not equipped.
I can't. No. It would be too heavy. I would shatter. I would burst into dust.
Yeah.
Okay. About 24% of faculty members in U.S. colleges and universities held full-time tenured appointments as of fall of 2021. However, this has gone down compared to the 39% in the fall of 1987. Most U.S. college and university faculty members held part and full-time non-tenure track appointments. So if you're employed on a non-tenure track, that would make you officially like a visiting professor.
Right.
Or
you don't
lecturer,
have the same protections.
Or an instructor. Yeah.
Yeah. It's almost like
title.
You're like a contract worker and they could end your contract kind of at any time.
That is my interpretation. Yes. Okay, so that's my background. And now I have.
Yeah, that was really interesting. I'm glad you covered that stuff.
Thanks.
And now I'm scared.
Yeah, you should be.
Great.
So the fan picker Anonymous did kind of want this case to be covered, but they were like, actually, that might be too dark. But I'm going to cover it anyway because.
All right, go off, queen.
It's kind of crazy. Okay. On February 12th, 2010, at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Is this ringing a bell?
Maybe not yet. I think so. Is this what's-her-face?
Well, biology professor Dr. Amy Bishop taught her anatomy and neurosciences class. According to a student in that class, she seemed, quote, perfectly normal during the lecture. After that class, she attended a biology department faculty meeting in room 369, on the third floor of the Shelby Center for Science and Technology, which houses the UA Huntsville Biology and Mathematics departments. I have a picture of the building on the drive, but you don't have to look at it yet because the other pictures are of her and she just looks like a... The hair! Just go look at the hair.
Okay. Oh.
Her haircut reminds me of that short, like, king in Shrek. Farquaad. Yeah.
Oh, my gourd.
Okay. The literal short king.
We stan a short king. Oh, yeah. Yikes. King. This is the most Lord Farquaad haircut I've ever fucking seen in my life.
No. Like.
No, honey.
What?
That is not it.
Well, she that only gets worse from here. Bob. A what?
A fuck ass Bob.
What's that?
I ended up on the fuck ass Bob side of TikTok where people are defining what is classified as a fuck ass Bob and what is just a Bob, just like a shitty Bob, like a I want to speak to the manager Bob.
Is fuck ass a good qualifier or is it like fucked up?
I think it depends. From what I understand, and you know, I am whiteness personified, so I am not the one to be reiterating this information. I could easily have misunderstood this, but from what I understand, a fuck ass Bob is like boss bitch, like this Bob will fuck you up, like sassy, like amazing, curated, like okay. That's a fuck ass Bob.
Okay.
This Bob is like a fucked up Bob. This is not. This is not it.
Would you even call it a Bob? It's so wide.
I know, but it's still, that's a Bob haircut. It's just really horrifying.
Yeah, it's not great.
Which is befitting of this person.
It sure is.
Yeah.
So, okay. Everything seemed perfectly normal. According to witnesses, 12 or 13 people attended the meeting, which was described as an ordinary faculty meeting. Everything's normal. There was no reason to be suspicious of what happened next.
Oh, God.
Amy Bishop sat quietly at the meeting for 30 or 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. Good amount of time.
That's why they recommend bourbon with your faculty meeting.
Yeah, none of this would have happened. Yeah. Ugh. Before pulling out a Ruger P95 9mm handgun just before 4 p.m.
In the faculty meeting?
According to one survivor, she, quote, got up suddenly, took out a gun, and started shooting at each one of us. She started with the one closest to her and went down the row, shooting her targets in the head. This wasn't a random shooting around the room. This was execution style. I have goosebumps. Look.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Ugh. Just really, really fucking gross. After Bishop had fired several rounds, Deborah Moriarty, the dean of the university's grad program and biochemistry professor, said that Bishop pointed the gun at her and pulled the trigger, but heard only a click as her gun either jammed or ran out of ammunition.
Oh my God, I feel lightheaded.
She described Bishop as initially appearing angry and then following the apparent weapon malfunction, perplexed. Like, ugh.
She wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, no. It was then that Moriarty and others in the room were able to push Bishop out of the room and barricade the door. Bishop apparently then went downstairs and hid the gun in the second floor bathroom. She didn't have a permit for this gun at all. Mm-mm. She apparently also called her husband and asked him to pick her up at that point.
Do you think she told? Did he know? Unclear.
He did not say that she told him that she just shot a bunch of people.
Okay.
So I think
whether or not he knew, we don't know because he's not going to willingly give that information.
So there was some testimony from their neighbors that they saw Amy and her husband like leaving that morning with like duffel bags.
Oh my God. So it's possible that he did help for this.
He said later that she asked him if she could borrow. It was his gun, I believe.
Okay.
And asked him if he could take her to the shooting range to learn how to use it.
Okay. Yeah.
So he had taken her to a shooting range in the weeks leading up to this.
Yeah.
But it's not clear. They can't prove that he knew.
No, there's enough plausible deniability. Like just wanting to go to the shooting range and be taught how to shoot a gun does not automatically give you, you know, full insight that this is what she was planning.
Correct. So as far as I know, he wasn't charged for any collusion or anything. So she was arrested just a few minutes later outside the building. Shortly after her arrest, Bishop was quoted as saying, "It didn't happen. There's no way." When asked about the deaths of her colleagues, Bishop replied, "There's no way. They're still alive."
Ugh.
She also claimed that she didn't remember doing it, but they weren't still alive.
I mean, did she just have a complete... Well, there's premeditation because she brought... she went to learn how to use the gun.
We will get to it because okay.
I'm just so confused.
This is not even the craziest part of this story.
My God. Okay.
So at this point, Bishop had killed three of her colleagues, Gopi Padilla, chairman of the biology department, Maria Ragland Davis, biology professor, and Adriel D. Johnson, senior, a biology professor. Oh. And then three others were wounded. These were Luis Regilio Cruz Vera, Joseph Leahy, and Stephanie Monticciolo.
Wow. Wow.
So this next part
frankly,
is...
it's a miracle that the gun either jammed or...
She could have killed every person in that room.
Everyone. Everyone. Mm-hmm. This makes me fucking sick.
It seems like that was her intention.
Yeah.
But like I said, all of this is strange, but it gets even weirder. And this is from the New York Times. Several people with connections to the university's biology department warned that Dr. Bishop, who was a neuroscientist with a Harvard PhD, might have booby-trapped the science building with some sort of herpes bomb, police officials said, designed to spread the dangerous virus. Only people who had worked with Dr. Bishop would know that she had done work with the herpes virus as a postdoctoral student and had talked about how it could cause encephalitis.
It sounds like in this creation that she made, it would vaporize the virus so that it's inhalable.
Yeah, I guess.
And then that could cause all of these other health issues. As yes. well as possibly expose your mouth.
Yeah.
To herpes.
So they didn't find anything, but okay. So the encephalitis, I would imagine, would happen to your children. Because I don't think you can just get encephalitis. Okay.
But if you're carrying the virus and then you can pass it through the birth.
Yeah. It could also. So it says she had also written an unpublished novel. Because she was also a novelist, in which a herpes-like virus spreads throughout the world, causing pregnant women to miscarry.
What on earth?
So, like I said, they didn't find any such advice, but these anxieties that prompted these reports were not entirely unfounded, because it turns out Amy was not well. So over the years, Dr. Bishop had shown evidence that the smallest of slights could set off a disproportionate and occasionally violent reaction, according to numerous interviews with colleagues and others who know her. Her life seemed to veer wildly between moments of cold fury and scientific brilliance, between rage at perceived slights and empathy for her students.
Yeah, this individual is unwell, like you said. I mean, that is not an excuse. And we are obviously, we do not vilify people who are struggling with their mental health. But this is shocking.
There were many instances where people could have and should have stepped in. And I'm going to get to the fucking list.
Yeah. We as a society need to fucking take mental health issues seriously, mostly because people with undiagnosed or untreated mental health issues can be a danger to themselves even mm-hmm. more than to others, but it mm-hmm. can happen.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, this is so fucking awful.
I know, it's very dark. So these shootings took place after Dr. Bishop learned that she had lost her long battle to gain academic tenure at the university.
Okay.
So she was denied tenure in March of 2009 and expected not to have her teaching contract renewed after March of 2010, and the shootings happened in February of 2010.
So that was the triggering event.
Mm-hmm. Wow. She had appealed the decision to the university's administration, but her appeal was denied. So she was expecting to lose her job at the University of Alabama a month later.
Oh my God. Oh my God. So I'll just kill a bunch of people who had nothing to do with that decision.
Mm-hmm.
Other staff.
Yeah.
I can't.
Yeah. But these shootings were hardly the first time that she had come to the attention of law enforcement because of an outburst or a violent act. In 2002, she was charged with assault after punching a woman in the head at an International House of Pancakes in Peabody, Massachusetts.
At an IHOP? Not even a Waffle House?
No, a fucking IHOP. The woman had taken the last booster seat, and according to the police report, Dr. Bishop demanded it for one of her children, shouting, "I am Dr. Amy Bishop."
Oh my God. You don't get to "don't you know who I am" about a booster seat at an IHOP, bitch.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck are you doing?
Also, nobody fucking knows who you are.
And if they did, nobody cares.
And if they did, that'd be more of a reason for them to kick you out of that IHOP.
Oh, I didn't realize she had kids. And kids young enough to need a booster seat.
That was in 2002. Yeah, I don't know much about her kids. I neglected to look into that, but
I guess this was 2002, but still. Blech, blech.
Yeah. In 1986, so this is when Amy was 21 years old and her brother Seth was 18 years old. Mm-hmm. So in 1986, she was at home. She had just gotten in a fight with her dad. Okay. Her dad left. Her brother was outside washing his car.
Uh-huh.
And her mom was like downstairs in the kitchen. Amy got pissed at her dad, went upstairs, got a shotgun out of her parents' closet, loaded it, fired one round, like a practice round, in her bedroom, and it like hit the wall, and she like tried to cover it up with, she like taped a book cover over it or something.
Oh, you've got to be kidding me. This is so, it's like the poster in the basement in the first season of Fargo. That's just like he put over a hole in the wall. Anyway, there's like three people that watch that show that are like, yeah, I thought about that too. Anyway, this is fucking stupid. This is so stupid. I hate this.
Then she went downstairs with this 12-gauge shotgun and shot her brother in the chest and killed him.
What?
She killed him. She put a gaping hole in his left chest and tore open his aorta, and he bled out in their kitchen in front of their mother. And when the cops came, that's not even the weirdest part.
Okay.
So he bled out in their kitchen in front of the mother. Amy ran out of the house with the shotgun, ran down the street to a car dealership, was walking around the car dealership lot with the shotgun.
With the gun. Okay.
Sales guy comes out and was like, are you okay? And she was like demanding a car. She's like, I need a car. Give me a car.
She was going to steal a car at gunpoint.
She said, I just got in a fight with my husband. He's after me. I need to get away. I need a car. That's what she told the guy at the car dealership. And then like the cops picked her up, brought her back to the house. The mother testified that the shooting was accidental. Well, she didn't even testify. She told the cops that. So the cops just took it as an accident. They also did not tie these two incidents together, the car what? Dealership and the shooting of her brother.
So wait. Are you, so did she not get arrested?
She was taken into custody and they were questioning her, and then her mom showed up at the cop shop and was like,
The cop shop and was like,
you're not answering any more questions. This was an accident. I'm taking her home. And so then the police took her word for it. I'm going to come back to this.
I am going to fall the fuck out of my chair.
Yeah. So Amy Bishop was not charged with the crime, and the shooting was never fully investigated by the police. Like I said, she and her family said it was an accident and the authorities accepted their version.
Also important to note, she is a white woman.
Yes.
That tells you all you fucking need to know. There's no way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this fucking makes my blood boil. Mm-hmm. Like, a black kid can't fucking wear his hood up and have Skittles in his fucking pocket, but this white woman can kill her brother, mm-hmm, and then go wave a gun around at a car dealership and try, mm-hmm, to steal a fucking car and have her white mom come and say, no, this has all been a huge misunderstanding, and then she's not charged.
Yep, and the cops came back to, like, help them clean up the blood in the kitchen, and they brought the family food.
I'm gonna fucking throw up.
So then in 1994, so this was 8 years later, she and her husband were questioned in a mail bomb plot.
What?
They were, they were making pipe bombs, and they mailed one of them to a doctor at Harvard, where she obtained her PhD and remained.
She and her husband were doing this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he's also got us fucking screw loose.
Yeah.
Whether or not he knew that she was going to kill her colleagues on that, like in that particular situation, they were definitely aligned on some of their, like, at least political or like personal ideation if they were doing this shit together.
You know who they remind me of? What the fuck was that family? And it's not just her haircut, although her haircut looks like the husband's haircut.
I can't with the Farquaad fucking haircut.
A couple years ago, there was like that family that had like 12 fucking kids that they kept chained up in their house. And there was only like one picture of them together in their pink plaid at their wedding or whatever.
Yeah. And didn't like the one of the daughters escape?
Yes.
Somehow.
One of the daughters escaped and had a cell phone and saved the rest of her siblings.
Yes. Yes. I remember that.
So those parents kind of remind me of Amy and her husband. It's a little bit because of the hair, but also just because of this like shared
kind of conspiracy delusion adjacent shit.
Yes. So they were just questioned about this plot because I don't think that the bomb was ever mailed. Don't really know for sure. But she was not charged with any of these things except for the IHOP incident where she was charged but never officially found guilty. So on paper, none of this ever happened.
If she was charged but not found guilty, it could have like been taken off of her record. And then no school, when they're running background checks, would know about this.
So her employers at the University of Alabama did not know about them.
I want to puke.
But as for the people who knew them, who knew her personally, her mood swings and volatility were very apparent. So here's some other shit
she creeped
that
out
she
her
did.
Colleagues along the way.
She yelled at playing children, according to her neighbors. She rarely kept her opinions to herself. She rejected criticism. She lied on her resume.
This is kind of sounding like me.
She lied on her resume. Her scientific work was not as impressive as she made it seem, according to independent neurobiologists, some of whom said she would have been unlikely to even get the opportunity to try for tenure at major universities. So she was just out of her fucking league and she was completely oblivious.
Or maybe she wasn't oblivious. If she lied, then she knew and just felt entitled to access to all of these privileges.
Yeah. Oblivious, I guess, isn't the right word.
Yeah.
She was so far up her own ass that she wouldn't take no for an answer.
That part.
She was known to have cyclical flip-outs, as one former student described them, that pushed one grad student after another out of her laboratory. Another incident in 1996 caused her to lose her job. Well, it caused her to not have her contract renewed, which is basically losing her job.
Right.
When she was not listed as the first author on a paper she collaborated on with at least one other researcher at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, which is affiliated with Harvard.
Okay.
So this researcher said, quote, she was very angry because she was not the first author. She broke down. She was extremely angry with all of us. She exploded into something emotional that we had never seen before in our careers. So back to her brother's shooting. So like I said, on the day she shot and killed her brother, she ran out onto the street with a shotgun and demanded a car at a local dealership. For whatever reason, the cops accepted the mother's story that the shooting was an accident and, like I said, did not tie both of these incidents together, which would have resulted in felony charges and likely a psychological evaluation.
She's a murderer.
And there are theories that the parents had ties with the local police. It's also not a big... It's not a large area. So it's got like kind of small town. It's
small town vibe.
Braintree. I don't get that name is disgusting.
We all know each other.
Yeah, they're looking out for each other. And then, like I said, the cops like helped them. And Judy, Judy, the mother, told the Braintree Forum and Observer a week after the shooting, quote, you cannot imagine how kind the Braintree police were to us.
Oh, I fucking bet, bitch. I fucking bet.
Also, like years after this incident, several like prosecutors, lawyers, investigators were like, this seems really fucking fishy, especially after the pipe bomb thing. Uh-huh. So they went back to try to like reinvestigate the brother's shooting. And
oh, I'm sure everything is gone.
The files are gone.
Yeah.
Everything's
There's
gone.
There's no way. Yeah. Because it wasn't her crime. So why would we keep this?
Yeah. Totally gone. So that was, that could have saved these three people's lives if she had gotten help at this point. So in September of 2012, Bishop pleaded guilty to one count of capital murder involving two or more people and three counts of attempted murder and was sentenced to life in prison without parole. The jury took 20 whole minutes to decide her sentence, and she
At least they were like, LOL, bye, bitch. Like, fuck you.
Yeah. She reportedly showed no emotion. So that is the story of Amy Bishop. There's like more, shockingly, but I couldn't get into all of it, but it's
I was like familiar nuts. I knew her name and I knew that there had been like a faculty shooting.
Yeah.
I didn't know the details of said shooting
or
anything else about this fucking monster.
Yeah. Isn't that fucking wild? Like, she's just a bad person. I mean,
yeah, that is
on top of mental. I mean, if your behavior points to your character, not great. And she should have been evaluated
long
when
ago
when she killed her brother in front of her mother. She wasn't even officially arrested or charged for any of that.
I'm rarely speechless, but holy shit.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, it was technically a school shooting, but not the kind that.
Right. That we're. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, great job.
Wishing you had that pint glass of vodka.
Kinda. I feel physically ill, like lightheaded.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take a quick sponsor break so I can like eat a cookie and get my composure. And then we can dive into some other deeply horrific shit for the second half of this episode.
Can't wait. Wouldn't Love be it. Mad if you tuned away. We'll be right back. Do you ever shy away from the mere thought of baking something because you have to like measure your ingredients so precisely and you have to let stuff rise and it just seems really, really daunting?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's kind of the mindset that I had about fresh baked items until I tried Wild Grain, because let me tell you, Wild Grain is a complete game changer. Obsessed with the croissants, obsessed with the chocolate chip cookies, the pastas. Mm. And it tastes like you yourself made it from scratch when really all you did was pull it out of your freezer and stick it in the oven for like 25 minutes max.
Yep.
Tell us more, Amanda.
So Wild Grain is the first ever bake from frozen subscription box for sourdough breads, fresh pastas, and artisanal pastries. Let me tell you, everything is so tasty. And like Lucy mentioned, every item bakes from frozen in 25 minutes or less, so there's no thawing required. You can put it in as is, babe. And you can now fully customize your Wild Grain box. So you can choose any combination of breads, pastas, and pastries. If you want to build a box that's only bread, babe, go for it. If you want only pasta, go for it. If you want only pastries, go for it. You will not regret
this. The world is
yours. Yeah, it's all yours, babe.
For a limited time, you can get $30 off your first box plus free croissants in every box when you go to wildgrain.com/gals to start your subscription. You heard me. Free croissants in every box. And $30 off your first box when you go to wildgrain.com/gals. That's wildgrain.com/gals. Or you can use promo code GALS at checkout. And treat your gluten.
Treat them. Something that Blue Land taught me is that detergent pods are wrapped in plastic. Like, it's dissolvable, but that film around your pod that you're using in, like, your dishwasher or your laundry machine is plastic, and it's ending up in our oceans, rivers, soil. Also, like, bodies. In our bodies. We're eating and drinking roughly a credit card's worth of plastic a week.
That's
y'all.
Disgusting.
I know. It literally shakes me to my core. And that is why I love Blue Land so much, because Blue Land set out to do something about it. Eliminate the need for single-use plastic in the products that we reach for the most.
And that includes dishwasher detergent, mm-hmm. laundry detergent, spray cleaners, toilet bowl cleaners. Mm-hmm. And these are just some of the things that Blue Land has available in a much more sustainable way. And they are effective.
Yeah.
So Blue Land is on a mission, like Amanda said, to eliminate single-use plastic by reinventing cleaning essentials to be better for you and the planet with the same powerful clean that you're used to. Blue Land uses no single-use plastic in any component, from bottles, tablets, and wrappers, even all to the shipping. Mm-hmm. Their tablet packaging is fully compostable. I'm a big fan of their toilet bowl cleaners.
Love.
They're just little tabs. They come in a tin box.
They're so cute.
It's so cute.
I just refilled my tin box for my dishwasher tabs.
Yes, the dishwasher tablets are so good. They're proven to perform on baked-on, burnt-on stains. It doesn't even require, a rinse aid.
No, let me tell you, I put some very gross dishes in my dishwasher because I'm a disgusting little piggy girl, and these things take good care of me.
Yes, all of Blue Land's products are effective and affordable. You can get even more savings by buying refills in bulk or setting up a subscription, so you're not going to run out of your most used products. These subscriptions are customizable and convenient. Couldn't be easier. Blue Land is trusted in over 1 million homes, including ours.
And Blue Land has a special offer for our listeners. Right now, get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/gals. You won't want to miss this. blueland.com/gals for 15% off. That's blueland.com/gals to get 15% off. And treat your clean.
Treat it.
All right. Well, I wish I could provide any levity after that.
Me too.
But I can't. This is a lot. So I'm just going to dive in. This is an unconventional case. And usually when we cover a crime, it's got a narrative, it's got characters, it's got a story that you can follow through until we hit motive, means, opportunity. It's, a person hurting another person. But in this situation, we're kind of all culprits, especially American society.
We're culpable.
In a way. I mean, okay. The perpetrators are systemic. The victims are hidden. There's faceless and vilified individuals here, some actual villains. And the narrative is serpentine. It's pretzeled up. We're just going to try to wade into this how we can.
Okay.
And we're just going to read some Department of Justice legal memos on a Friday afternoon, which is totally normal.
I love that.
Yep. So our victim would be Human Decency. Our perpetrator would be the United States government.
Yeah.
And there are multiple individuals at fault here, but for the purpose of today's case, we're specifically going to be talking about John Yoo, who was the department. John Yoo.
Oh.
The Deputy Assistant Attorney General. The murder weapon, corrupted self-serving logic loops and utter bullshit. And the motive, xenophobia and post 9/11 hysteria.
Okay. This is serpentine.
Yep. So we're going to be talking about what has come to be known as the torture memos.
Oh.
And there are a few examples that fit academic atrocity quite so well. Hmm. So for context and why this fits with today's topic, we're going to give you a little bit of background on John Yoo. And he is a South Korean-born American legal scholar and former government official who currently serves, as the Emanuel S. Heller Professor of Law at the University of California in Berkeley. Yoo became known for his legal opinions concerning executive power, warrantless wiretapping, and the Geneva Conventions while serving in the George W. Bush administration.
Oh, got it. Don't even need to ask what those opinions were.
Yep. During which he was the author of the controversial, quote, torture memos in the War on Terror. So his status in academia, specifically the study of law, gave him the power to change what I guess you could call in the interrogation playbook of war in like a deep and terrifying way.
Jesus.
Yeah. So
speaking
for
of
those,
Oppenheimer.
Yeah, seriously. For those listening who were like born in 2001, post 9/11, this country went absolutely batshit crazy. It was clear that the cycle of violence was going to significantly escalate. And those of us, you know, who were in the streets protesting against this like death spiral and pending war were in an embarrassing minority. And, you know, it's just funny how fucking history repeats itself and how relevant this feels today. Mm-hmm. When the U.S. launched its global war on terror, they found themselves in uncharted waters with enemies that were not easy to categorize, paranoia at unprecedented levels. And like, we were just being lied to left and right by the government about like who had weapons of mass destruction, where the threat was. It was a fucking mess.
It was like such a patriotism was just crammed down your throat, but it wasn't.
It really was.
It wasn't as obviously propaganda-y as it is mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. I think it was a lot easier to kind of swallow because we had been attacked.
Right. Yeah. It was a really
weird fucking time.
Really fucking weird time. And I think it's safe to say that we suffered post-traumatic stress as a country and we were not handling it well at all.
No.
And in our hunt for the enemy, certain legal questions arose. And that's where John Yoo and folks who, you know, like the assistant district attorney or whatever at the time also like signed off on these memos. So like there were teams of people kind of guided by this renowned legal mind in academia who were guiding this narrative and writing these procedures.
Yeah. We had to look to some people.
Uh-huh.
And he sounds smart.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm not saying that this individual isn't smart, but I'm saying that intellect can be weaponized, and it absolutely was. Mm-hmm. So the term torture memos has come to refer to three documents prepared by the Department of Justice. These documents advise the Central Intelligence Agency, the United States Department of Defense, and the president on the use of enhanced interrogation techniques, including mental and physical torment and coercion, such as prolonged sleep deprivation, binding in stress positions, and waterboarding.
Mm-hmm.
God. And stated that such acts, widely regarded as torture, might be legally permissible under an expansive interpretation of presidential authority during the war on terror. Quote, torture memo, standards of conduct for interrogation under 18 U.S.C. sections 2340 through 2340A is the primary torture memo which defines the DOJ's interpretation of torture. Written in response to the president's reported request for a legal opinion on the U.N. Convention Against Torture. So this is where, like, John Yoo's authority is directly asked for by the president. And 18 U.S.C. section 2340 and the interrogation of Al-Qaeda operatives. It discusses the language of the torture statute in detail in order to derive its definition of torture and states that cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment is not torture, according to the statute, and examines, quote, possible defenses that would negate any claim that certain interrogation methods violate the statute. Mm-hmm. It concludes that torture is only extreme acts, according to the United Nations Convention Against Torture, that severe pain is a requisite for this definition of torture, and that the definition of severe pain is, quote, serious physical injury such as organ failure, impairment of bodily function, or even death, and that prolonged mental harm is harm that must last for months or even years.
So keeping someone awake or in one of those white rooms for days
would probably be fine under this definition.
Jesus Christ.
Because it's kind of like intentionally vague.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so that you can get away with a lot of shit.
You'd think that a convention against torture would be operating with the purpose of preventing torture.
You'd think.
And not just defining it vaguely.
Yep. It also stated that prosecution under section 2340A may be barred because enforcement of the statute would represent an unconstitutional infringement of the president's authority to conduct war. And that under the current circumstances, necessity or self-defense may justify interrogation methods that might violate section 2340A.
Self-defense.
Yep.
Cool. Got it. Well, he's just jumping through all these loopholes, huh?
Yep. To go a little deeper into John Yoo's kind of, academic definitions here. So these are some more excerpts from these memos. Torture means an act committed by a person acting under the color of law, specifically intended to inflict severe physical or mental pain or suffering, other than pain or suffering incidental to lawful sanctions, upon another person with his custody or physical control. There's also a segment in here that says, whoever outside the United States commits or attempts to commit torture shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 20 years or both. And if death results to any person from conduct prohibited by this subsection, shall be punished by death or imprisoned for any term of years or for life. So that's applicable to people outside of the United States committing these same acts. But that the U.S. is essentially like exempt.
Huh.
The memo also creates some pretty questionable cover for people who participate in these extreme interrogations. So remember, it says like you have to specifically intend to inflict severe physical or mental pain, mm-hmm. which is like the hardest part to prove in a court of law, mm-hmm. is did they mean to do it?
Did they mean to drown this man with a wet rag?
Exactly. To violate 2340A, the statute requires that severe pain and suffering must be inflicted with specific intent. In order for a defendant to have acted with specific intent, he must expressly intend to achieve the forbidden act. As a result, the defendant had to act with the express, quote, purpose to disobey the law in order for the mens rea element to be satisfied.
Well, torture, your intention isn't to kill. Your intention is to elicit
get information.
Information.
Mm-hmm. In theory. So like, whoopsie whoopsie, a little light torture doesn't count unless you meant it to be bad.
Unless you meant to kill them, which...
Or meant to hurt them.
Yeah.
This includes harm, like severe pain. It's wild to me. The memorandum, concludes with a narrow definition of torture that it's, quote, severe pain must necessarily be pain associated with death, organ failure, or serious impairment of bodily functions. It also states that the statute requires prolonged mental harm to accompany mental or physical pain, and that prolonged means a duration of months or years. So again, just like...
Three or 4 weeks doesn't count.
Right.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
So we used these tactics during the War on Terror.
And these excuses and these loopholes.
Yep. So the interrogation of, it's Abu Zubaydah, right? I'm pretty sure it's Zubaydah.
Sure. That looks right.
So the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah followed these ideas and was laid out in detail in a memo written for John Rizzo, who was the acting general counsel of the CIA at the time. The question was, what can we do and not wind up in jail while we're like trying to figure out where WMDs might be or like who was behind 9/11, etc.
Oh, God.
So this memo lays that out and it is utterly horrifying and we're gonna go over it because that's what we do on this show. So this is the interrogation of Al-Qaeda operative memo for John Rizzo, acting general counsel of the CIA.
Great.
So Zubaydah is one of the highest ranking, according to this memo, is one of the highest ranking members of the Al-Qaeda terrorist organization, with which the United States is currently engaged in an international armed conflict following the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on September 11, 2001. The interrogation team is certain that he has additional information that he refuses to divulge. Specifically, he is withholding information regarding terrorist networks in the United States or in Saudi Arabia and information regarding plans to conduct attacks within the United States or against our interests overseas. Zubaydah has become accustomed to a certain level of treatment and displays no signs of willingness to disclose further information. Moreover, your intelligence indicates that there is currently a level of chatter equal to that which preceded the September 11th attack. So like an indication that other attacks would be coming. There's like water cooler gossip.
Okay.
About terrorism.
Yeah.
In light of the information you believe Zubaydah has and the high level of threat you believe now exists, you wish to move the interrogations into what you have described as, quote, an increased pressure phase.
Who is so you?
You is like the United States government. This is like a memo that went to the like guy running the CIA at the time.
Okay, because we've got the guy, you, and now we have this weirdly ambiguous Y-O-U.
Yep. So John Yoo is the one who kind of like set up the parameters for what's torture and what isn't. Mm-hmm. And now these parameters are being specifically applied, or like we're about to apply them to Zabeda, which is, this is basically like, here's why we're going to torture him, written in a memo for the acting general counsel of the CIA. Basically, it's like, here's the formal request for us to up the ante on how we're getting information out of this individual and the ways that they want to torture him to get this information are available because of John Yoo's torture memos.
Got it. Okay. It just, so, the language is a little bit confusing.
And it's all fucking legal jargon to make it like very dry and confusing. But that essentially, this is like the formal request that we move into the quote, increased pressure phase.
And we're justified in doing it for these reasons.
And here are the tactics that you have sanctioned that we want to use. So this is the overview of the increased pressure phase on Zabeda.
Great.
This increased pressure phase will likely last no more than several days, but could last up to 30 days. In this phase, you would like to employ 10 techniques that you believe will dislocate his expectations regarding the treatment he believes he will receive and encourage him to disclose the crucial information mentioned above. These techniques would be used as needed and will not necessarily include all, and expect to be used in some sort of escalating fashion, culminating with the waterboard, though not necessarily ending with this technique. The techniques include attention grasp, which is grasping the individual with both hands, one hand on each side of the collar opening, in a controlled and quick motion. In the same motion as the grasp, the individual is drawn toward the interrogator. So it's like roughing you up. Hmm. Walling. A flexible false wall will be constructed. The individual is placed with his heels touching the wall. The interrogator pulls the individual forward and then quickly and firmly pushes the individual into the wall. It is the individual's shoulder blades that hit the wall. During this motion, the head and neck are supported with a rolled hood or towel that provides a C-collar effect to help prevent whiplash, thank God. To further reduce the probability of injury, the individual is allowed to rebound from the flexible wall. You have orally informed us that the false wall is in part constructed to create a loud sound when the individual hits it, which will further shock or surprise the individual. In part, the idea is to create a sound that will make the impact seem far worse than it is, and that will be far worse than any injury that might result from the action. So it's like bark over bite.
Slamming against the wall.
Right. A facial hold. The facial hold is used to hold the head immobile. The one open palm is placed on either side of the individual's face. The fingertips are kept well away from the individual's eyes. A facial slap, so literally slapping somebody in the face over and over and over again. Cramped confinement, so they either build or provide some kind of confined space. It's usually in the dark.
Like a crate?
It's like the chokey from fucking Matilda.
Matilda, ooh.
The duration of confinement varies based upon the size of the container that's available.
Mm.
For the larger confined space, the individual can stand up or sit down. The smaller space is large enough for the subject to sit down. Confinement in the larger space can last up to 18 hours. For the smaller space, confinement lasts for no more than 2 hours. Sorry, in the confined space, they cannot sit down. They have to stand.
Yeah, and all that's only if they can only find a small box to put them in.
Mm-hmm. They'll make them do wall standing, which is used to induce muscle fatigue. They stand about 4 to 5 feet from a wall with their feet spread approximately shoulder width apart, arms stretched out in front of them with their fingers resting on the wall. Fingers support all of their body weight, and the individual is not permitted to move or reposition their hands or feet for hours.
Oh my God.
Putting them in stress positions. A variety of stress positions may be used. You have informed us that these positions are not designed to produce the pain associated with contortions or twisting of the body. Rather, somewhat like walling, they are designed to produce the physical discomfort associated with muscle fatigue. Two particular stress positions are likely to be used on Zabeda. One, sitting on the floor with legs extended straight out in front of him with his arms raised above his head, and two, kneeling on the floor while leaning back at a 45-degree angle. You have also orally informed us that through observing Zabeda in captivity, that's literally written in here, like an animal.
Yeah.
You have noted that he appears to be quite flexible despite his wound. So he was already injured at this time.
Oh my God.
and they noted that the wound was sustained during capture. Now, I'm not, as a humanist, I understand that some of the tactics that, like, some of the people that we use these tactics on are not good fucking people. I'm not saying that, like, we should all be simping for, like, known terrorists.
Yeah.
It's just the fact that we can do this legally and essentially have carte blanche to operate outside of the Geneva Convention in, like, any capacity is such a slippery slope.
Yeah.
And to know the details of, like, what we were doing.
That you're just kind of, like, clevering your way out of parameters that have been adopted
for a reason.
Globally. Well, not globally.
Because they're because they're inhumane.
Yeah.
So it's just, I just wanted to make that clear, you know, because I'm sure that, I don't know. I just needed to say it.
Yeah. I don't want to come off as defending this dude.
No, of course not.
But yeah. And the descriptions of some of these procedures, I can feel it.
They're very scary.
Mm-hmm.
Sleep deprivation is one of them. Insects placed in a confinement box. So you could put someone, they wanted to put him specifically in a cramped confinement box full of insects. It's like some Fear Factor shit.
Jesus.
And they wanted to get this cleared because he expressed a fear of insects, like, in particular.
Oh.
And they wanted to use stinging insects in the
box.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
It's really sick that there's, like, some creative ingenuity involved in developing these.
Well, yeah, you get a psychological profile on somebody and you know what their fears are and then you use them.
Yeah, and even just, like, physiologically, the wall stuff and the fingertip stuff and the mm-hmm. bending and the, like, you gotta, there's somebody out there who designed these specifically.
Yeah. So the final escalation would be the waterboard. In this procedure, the individual is bound securely on an inclined bench, which is approximately 4 feet by 7 feet. The individual's feet are generally elevated. A cloth is placed over the forehead and eyes. Water is then applied to the cloth in a controlled manner. As this is done, the cloth is lowered until it covers both the nose and mouth. Once the cloth is saturated and completely covers the mouth and nose, airflow is slightly restricted. It's very fucking restricted. People have definitely died being waterboarded.
Mm-hmm. You're drowning.
Yeah, for 20 to 40 seconds due to the presence of the cloth. This causes an increase in carbon dioxide level in the individual's blood. This increase in the carbon dioxide level stimulates increased effort to breathe. So, like, while you can't breathe, your body is fighting to breathe and you're just sucking in this wet cloth. Mm-hmm. And it's like you can't control how much you, like, escalate your breathing. This effort plus the cloth produces the perception of drowning. The individual does not breathe any water into his lungs. Let me make that clear. Okay.
Sure.
During those 20 to 40 seconds, water is continuously applied from a height of 12 to 24 inches. So water's just, like, falling on your face. After this period, the cloth is lifted and the individual is allowed to breathe unimpeded for 3 to 4 full breaths. And then they start over again. You can kind of catch your breath 3 or 4 breaths. And then they repeat this over and over again. You have already informed us that it is likely that this procedure would not last more than 20 minutes in any one application.
Likely.
Yeah, it's very intentionally vague. They then go on to explain that these should not result in any prolonged mental harm and as they use these procedures on their own military personnel in their training to resist interrogations. So it's like we do this to our own guys to train them in case they get captured and interrogated. So it's not that bad.
We're just inflicting trauma on everyone.
Mm-hmm.
You don't just get over that.
Yeah. The Navy specifically continues to use waterboarding in training, and they have not encountered any significant long-term mental health consequences from its use, according to this memo.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like, I feel like it's disingenuous to claim that training to experience torture and actually being tortured is even, like, comparable.
If your body has that panic reaction, that's not something that can be trained out of you.
No, and I'm not saying that there isn't harm in using that as a training exercise, but, like, as a training exercise, it's in a much more controlled and, like, you know, ideally safe environment.
Yeah, you're not scared shitless. You aren't,
yeah, and you're, like, prepared. You're like, okay, I know this is part of my training.
Yeah.
You're not going to be killed by taking this too far. And, you know, most likely, God willing. But, mm-hmm. like, So I just feel like that's not a fair comparison to be like, we do it to our own for training, so it's fine to do it to a terrorist.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
Because they're not being applied in the same circumstances. I don't know. It's just, it's not the fucking same. So this continues to say, your psychological assessment indicates that it is believed Zubeda wrote Al-Qaeda's manual on resistance techniques. You also believe that his experiences in Al-Qaeda make him well acquainted with and well versed in such techniques. So it's like he's experienced this and administered this himself. It's not like he's going to be new to these tactics.
Okay.
Yeah. It's
the same thing on the other side of the coin. Like,
yeah,
it's not the same.
And like I said, so Zubeda stated during interviews that he thinks of any activity outside of jihad as silly. He has indicated that his heart and mind are devoted to serving Allah. And, you know, he has been very clear that he is aligned with jihad and believes that the global victory of Islam is inevitable. And like, he has made clear that he continues to express his unabated desire to kill specifically Americans and Jewish people. Like, he is a very bad man. And like I said before, I don't condone a goddamn thing that this man has done or incited. Mm-mm. And I also believe that a person's villainy should not negate our humanity, because that slope is so fucking slippery. Mm-hmm. Like, we have to, multiple things can be true at once. And if we don't hold those truths very carefully and with intention, we can do some serious irrevocable fucking harm.
Yes.
And just because no one's going to lose a wink of sleep over torturing like this guy doesn't mean that it should be allowed to use these methods on basically anyone that the government, which cannot be fucking trusted,
yeah,
deems a threat. It's the slope is just too fucking slippery for me. It makes me very, very uncomfortable that we have legal protections to do this kind of shit to basically anyone that we deem a threat.
So did these memos then create the precedence that this can continue happening, or have they been shut down since?
So all of this was kind of kept pretty under wraps by the government for a considerable amount of time. But then things started getting leaked in 2004, because like, leaks gonna leak. It's gonna happen. So in 2004, a now infamous and disturbing photo of the torture of Abu Hussein Saad Faleh made it onto the cover of The Economist and CBS News. And the Abu Ghraib torture and prisoner abuse scandal in Iraq had like officially broken in the press. So in that press leak, it was revealed that during the early stages of the Iraq War, members of the United States Army and the CIA committed a series of human rights violations and war crimes against detainees in the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, including physical abuse, sexual humiliation, both physical and psychological torture, rape, the killing of Manadel al-Jamadi, and the desecration of his body. These abuses came to public attention, like I said, with the publication of photographs of the abuse by CBS News in April of 2004, and the incidents caused shock and outrage, receiving widespread condemnation within the United States and internationally. And the UN just being like, hey, these are fucking war crimes.
Yeah.
Like, also, we have rules of war for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Also a bit of like the Vietnam syndrome. Like,
yes,
people don't. People can, you know, be behind their patriotism, their nationalism, be all about a war if you feel like it's justified.
Sure.
But then as soon as you start seeing photographs of the effect of that conflict.
Yeah, it can change your mind pretty quick.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, we as a society, especially in the West, we glamorize war so much.
We don't see it right in front of us.
Yeah. And then when you are actually seeing the real fucking on the ground shit, it's why it's like so important that we don't look away. So obviously there was outrage and people were calling on the Bush administration to fucking be accountable for this shit. And the George W. Bush administration claimed that these instances were isolated incidents and not indicative of U.S. policy.
There's just dozens of isolated incidents.
Yeah. Yeah. This isn't us. That's like that was one time. It's one bad apple. It's fine. Of course, humanitarian organizations determined that was a lie. So like cue Maury Povich. But some kind of joke in here because this is so fucking horrific. Multiple humanitarian organizations stated that the abuses at Abu Ghraib were part of a wider pattern of torture and brutal treatment at American overseas detention centers, including those in Iraq, Afghanistan, and at Guantanamo Bay, which, like, you know, we know Guantanamo Bay is a fucking hellscape. Mm-hmm. So then the torture memos came to light a few years after this initial torture scandal broke. Mm. And those documents issued in multiple memoranda were prepared in the months leading up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq by the U.S. State Department of Justice and like written by John Yoo. And overall, they authorized certain enhanced interrogation techniques, heavy quotes, which is like torture to foreign detainees. Can't be used on United States Americans, but we can use it abroad. Those memos also argued that international humanitarian laws, such as the Geneva Conventions, did not apply to American interrogators overseas. So like when we're doing it, it doesn't count.
How did they come to that conclusion?
I mean, we'd have to be law professors and pore through all of the memos. And I already, like, my brain is scrambled eggs reading this.
I'm reaching my limits here. But like, that's just the gymnastics.
It's wild. Ugh. So John Yoo concluded that federal laws prohibiting the use of torture did not apply to U.S. practices overseas. And that's like that right there is the like main crux of the issue.
That's the gist. How fucked up that is by itself.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my
God. Several subsequent U.S. Supreme Court decisions, including Hamdan v. Rumsfeld in 2006, have overturned Bush administration policy, ruling that the Geneva Conventions do apply to us abroad, thank God.
Yeah. Well, there's got away with it for quite a while.
For a really fucking long time. I mean, can't you just feel the fucking freedom?
I feel it. It's coursing through my veins. I feel it pulsing on my forehead right here.
Yeah, that one vein and my eye twitching.
Mm-hmm.
So there's obviously so much more to this and like a lot that I do not have the intellectual capacity to understand. I did the best that I could. And we don't have the show format to go much deeper. Like there could be entire and probably are like huge documentary length.
Oh, yeah.
Shows about these memos specifically. But what this really affirms to me is that like academia and knowledge can be used for evil as much as it's used for good. And human beings can intellectualize ourselves into literally condoning torture in like if the right academic is writing the rules.
Yeah.
And like I keep saying, regardless of the villainy and horrifying acts of the people that may or may not have had this torture inflicted upon them, setting that precedent that we can do this abroad is very fucking dangerous. And we have to pay attention to shit like that.
Yeah.
Because we're gonna fucking keep, you know, the West is gonna atrocity and we're gonna keep committing them. Right, Pepperoni? Yeah. That just made Pepperoni yowl. I don't know if that got picked up on the mic, but girl, I know, right?
Oh.
It's just really scary shit. And like, there's so much that I couldn't include, but I mean, the shit we've done and the shit we continue to do is fucking depraved. And we have to be paying attention. And like, I'm very grateful for whistleblowers and people who do leak this kind of information that's typically kept behind closed doors by the government, because otherwise we just wouldn't really know.
Yeah. And until we get over this idea of American exceptionalism.
Yes.
We're not going to collectively come to that agreement.
People genuinely believe
that they don't apply to Americans overseas.
Yeah, this rules for thee and none for me bullshit, backed up by like brilliant legal minds that are brought in to use their academic strengths to like essentially
justify
and like write this into the very law of how we commit war
and how we interrogate those precedences. I'm sure that's what they wanted. That was the goal.
That was exactly the goal. It's just like, it's very fucking scary shit. It's scary shit. And this is like, we don't know what we see that the government is doing on a day-to-day basis is always going to be the tip of the iceberg. We don't have access to these behind closed doors conversations. And like that shit makes me uncomfortable because the shit that's happening behind closed doors is the most atrocious shit.
Mm-hmm. It's also the shit that matters the most.
Yeah. So God bless the leakers.
Yeah.
Who are leaking this shit. Please keep leaking.
Continue leaking.
Continue to leak. Anyway, that's my segment.
I loved it. I do have whistleblowers on the calendar.
You do. You do. I know. I mean, I probably could have used this in that capacity as well, but we're going to do something a little more fun for that.
There's a lot of fun whistleblowing.
There. I mean, the aliens? Come on.
Come on.
Come on.
God. Well, ooh, I thought this episode would be a little more fun.
It's always the ones that we think will be chill that are the most horrifying.
Yeah. Well, thanks. No wonder this fan picker wanted to stay anonymous.
Stay anonymous. That was swore. I want to fucking stay anonymous.
Well, now we all need a fucking pint of vodka. So
I'm going to go have a pint of vodka and roll a nice fat J.
That sounds really good.
Yeah, honey.
On that note, thank you so much for listening. Thank you, anonymous fan picker. And everyone, take care of your mental health.
Yep. Everybody go make a therapy appointment and take your meds.
Yeah. Okay.
We love you.
See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Wine and Crime. Our cover art is by Kala Yip. Music by Phil Young and Corey Wendell. Editing by Jonathan Camp. Our production manager is Andrea Gardner. For photos and sources, check out our blog at wineandcrimepodcast.com. You can follow us on all the socials at wineandcrimepod. If you have questions, answers, or recommendations to share, email us at wineandcrimepodcast@gmail.com. Episodes are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. It is the best way to spread the word. If you'd like to show your support and get access to all sorts of wine-fueled bonus content, visit our Patreon page. Cheers!